All right, welcome to the news, the last news of the year. We actually thought, I think last year we did sort of just a whole review of the year and had like as many people, as close to everybody here as we could, but we can't do that this year, partly because Carolyn Payne takes up so much room now. because of
I'd explain that.
Well, she needs two chairs because she has a broken ankle. And plus, remember, like, was anybody on that show?
Yes.
So we had to keep moving people around, right?
I loved it.
Well, what are we going to do over here?
That's true.
I can scoot. I can, like, glide on the chairs.
Right. So Carolyn Payne has a broken ankle. That's not the main thing about her, though. She's an actress, comedian, dancer, founder and choreographer, but not this year a dancer in the Kinetic Dance Ensemble. They just got through their Nutcracker Sweet and Spicy, the highlight of the Hartford holiday season. Tanisha Dugan is a producing associate at Theater Works in Hartford. Rich Holland is principal and design director at CoLab in Hartford. And Bill Usman, director of the Media Literacy and Digital Culture Graduate Program, School of Communication and Media Arts at Sacred Heart University. I don't even know why we have four nose panelists this time, but it could be like if the trainers pull you out of the game or something like that.
Yeah,
you
know, yeah.
Really, she can't start the second half. She's just not up to it. All right, so what we're going to do in the second segment today is talk about The Crown, which is the hit series. I think it's fair to call it a hit series on Netflix. Also, supposedly the most expensive TV series ever made. And that's because they actually have to, like, build a, you know, a Buckingham Palace.
You gotta build Buckingham Palace
like
for it.
really costs a lot of money. Whereas, like, in Game of Thrones, they just do green screens and stuff like that. All right, so, but that's still to come. In the beginning of the show, we're going to talk about, I think, sort of an article that has triggered a debate about something called sensitivity readers in the publishing industry. We may or may not fold into this something about Bono. I don't know whether we'll get there or not, but... although making fun of Bono is so much fun that it's kind of like, it would be a shame if we didn't. But right now we're going to talk about an article by Alexandra Alter in last Sunday's New York Times. It links out to a whole bunch of other articles as well. The headline was a little bit provocative. In an era of online outrage, do sensitivity readers result in better books or censorship? I'll try to summarize the article. It's about the fact that certain books for young adult readers and children are passed through now what are called sensitivity readers at publishing houses. They read from the perspective usually of some ethnicity or minority group or gender difference or something like that and make sure that that outlook is accurately reflected. But I think the article sort of describes more than that. It describes certain books that are being pulled from the market often after they encounter online outrage from early readers, even if they have been through the sensitivity reader gauntlet. And so anyway, I mean, there's a lot to say about this. I guess, Rich, maybe we'll start with you because I think maybe you – I mean, all of us have sort of different takes on this thing. I sense for you that you in some ways think that this notion is probably a pretty healthy development.
Yeah, well, so the framing of the headline is particularly binary. So it's saying, like, does having folks who review your work through a specific cultural filter, will they make the book better or will they make the book worse? Well, I mean, if you're forced to answer that question, then, you know, then you fall into the trap. You know, I think that what the potential of the of sensitivity readers is to create intentionality, right? And I mean, so did you actually mean to say this? And I think that one could say the same thing with a grammar checker. You know, is the way you're wording this, is this really what you meant? And then you get a choice to say, yeah, that's what I meant, or no, that's not what I meant. I understand that there's some concerns about, you know, are we editing people's thoughts? Should we let this stuff actually play out live and let this go to market and let these conversations happen in the market as opposed to a preempted conversation? I think that that's kind of got limited value, right? Because I take a look at what the individual author's benefit is, and I think that they get the full benefit of the experience of recognizing what they're actually biasing into their work, whether it's in the market or prior to the market. So I think that question gets neutralized about whether people grow individually through this editing process. So I think as a tool that that clarifies intention and makes sure what's in your book is what you want in your book, it's great. Now, if what that's leading to is a kind of cowardice on the part of the publishers who are more concerned with making money and selling books than producing good content, perhaps, that could be a problem. But I don't think that the fault there is on the on the review and the critique. I think the fault there is on, you know, what folks are ready to publish.
Yeah, I mean, Tanisha, it seems like it's not just the one thing, right? It's not the idea of sensitivity readers, because maybe used in the discerning way that Rich is describing, maybe they could be a good thing. But the problem is they're not operating in a vacuum. These books come out. Sometimes the early readings trigger these online furors, which are often added to by people who haven't even read the book but have decided to chime in that the book is disgusting or evil or depraved or racist or something like that. Publishers are pulling books off the market. One book called When We Were Fierce has been indefinitely shelved since last August. And so that's the question. Maybe the question is, sensitivity readers might be a good idea if we can trust the publishing industry to handle them responsibly and courageously.
Yeah, I think that is possibly a rubric to use. But I also think we don't really know how these conversations are happening between author and sensitivity reader. And the article doesn't illuminate what those conversations look like, really. And so for me, that's sort of where the juice is. Mm-hmm. Because if the person who is, in your example, asking you, is this what you really mean? And then you're having a conversation. Well, yes, that is what I really mean. I am trying to illuminate a particular kind of person or a particular kind of life or way of thinking. And that sensitivity reader says, okay, well, you've definitely done that. It may be offensive. And the author then stands behind their intention and goes forward with that. And then the conversation with the publishing house becomes, well, this is the book that the writer wants to write. Do you feel comfortable publishing it? That to me is a little bit different than let's scrub your writing of anything that may trigger anybody. Because I find a little bit of I question the idea that selling the books is dependent on its comfort level. I actually think there's a certain degree of outrage that is inherent in the way in which we purchase things nowadays. I love a hate purchase as much as I do a love purchase.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, if we're coming from a straight capitalist perspective, I think you let the art do or the artist do what they think, what fulfill their vision and let things fall as they may. We may not live in that world anymore, but I hope we get there.
Although, Bill, you thought there was something kind of corporately self-protective about some of this stuff.
Yeah, I think that the impulse behind this could potentially be a really positive thing. I mean, if we think about this as organic or grassroots in any way, I think this is a lot about people who have for long been underrepresented or misrepresented, saying, like, we're not just going to sit back and take that anymore. We want to, you know, have some voice about how you are representing us. But I'm not sure that it is how organic it really is, or if it's kind of a public relations move by the public relations industries, the publishing industries, as a response to what they're worried about in terms of online outrage. We're going to try to stop the online outrage before it begins because we're concerned about our public image and selling our books rather than because we're really concerned about how people are being represented.
And even worse, and maybe more cynical, as I looked at the photos in that article, it also feels like a depository for diversity hiring, where you put all of the people of color that you want to have at your publishing house and you put them in these jobs where they are then speaking for the people, which is
an issue right there.
I think that's absolutely correct. And in one of the articles that we read, they even talked about, well, this is opening up more, you know, jobs for diverse people in the publishing industry. But my response to that is, how about actually actually publishing their books. Mm-hmm. If right. you want
or
actual...
making them really, really legit editors.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So Carolyn, one of the things described in that New York Times article was an author named Laura Moriarty. I think her book is called American Heart. It's a book about prejudice and more than prejudice, persecution of Muslims, and about a white protagonist who decides to do something about it. This is, once again, a young adult novel. She actually did everything right. She consulted with Muslim people as she was writing the book. Then her publisher had two sensitivity readers read the book from a Muslim perspective. Then the book was reviewed in Kirkus by a Muslim American female critic and given a star, the coveted star, and a very positive review. And then there was one of these online outrage storms that even has caused Kirkus to remove its star, rewrite its review. And it's one of these things, I mean, I don't know. I since you're a comedian, among other things, I connected to a little bit of like Seinfeld and Chris Rock refusing to perform on college campuses anymore. It's like, you can't win this game.
Yeah, I think for me, this article, because one of the things that I struggle with as a comedian is being willing to just kind of like push that envelope and like say things that you know might like put people on edge, just because sometimes that push is like part of that dialogue in comedy and finding things that you that are uncomfortable, like living in that space. And the online outrage is with everything. I feel like everything online leads to outrage. There is no road on the internet that leads to a happy ending. And in some ways, I think that it's a marketing ploy, because you read these things and you hate buy, you hate watch, because you've read so many bad things about it, and you're just going into it wanting to just see this like lowest common denominator, like scum of existence piece of literature or a TV show or a movie. And then you end up judging it for yourself, and you see what they're saying, but you're like, wow, that did not warrant that at all. One of the things I binge watched this week was that movie on Netflix with Will Smith. This is embarrassing. I can't even remember the title.
Bright.
Thank you. I wanted to say Blaze, but I knew that wasn't it. And, you know, everyone's loving that. Like, it's getting these amazing reviews. And it was an example of something that I watched thinking it was going to be great, because there wasn't, you know, all this, like, online rage about it. And honestly, if I was somebody who sat around and went online, I'd have some online rage about that. So it just goes to show that everyone is going to be entitled to an opinion. And I just think that this trying to be sensitive is, yes, there is an important way to go about this and to not put out inflammatory things into a world that is filled with this, you know, underlying flame and rage. But I think at the same time, we do need sometimes a little bit more provocation.
I'm not against the flames.
Yeah.
So I think, to me, if we're using – so it gets back to this idea of authenticity for me, right? Mm-hmm. If we're using brand politics, political correctness or political sensitivity as a means of brand insurance – then what are we really doing? That's nothing. That's inauthentic. That's closeted every kind of ism that I can imagine. Because you're not actually really getting into the weeds of what the issues are at all. You're doing everything you can to avoid criticism, and that to me is the beginning of the death of culture. Though that might be a bit hyperbolic. but I still get back to this idea of, like, you know, let's have these conversations and let's really start to know. Because and I guess in a way this is where Bono comes into this.
Well
circled, sir.
The thing that kind of bugs
me. I'm the host, and I couldn't figure out how to do that.
The thing that bugs me more than this idea of you know, I had this idea reviewed, mm-hmm. and I stand behind it, is putting things out into the universe that you actually mean to put out into the universe. And when you're met with criticism, you step into the, like, oh, golly gee, I didn't really mean that. Mm-hmm. Who, me? Mm-hmm. I'm Bono. And
we should explain that Bono has to do with this is that in an interview, in a much larger context, he said that girly music, as he put it, was beginning to dominate rock and roll, and took some heat about that.
Yeah, and I think he should take some heat about that. And I don't think that he should be taking, you know, Al Franken heat about it. And I don't think that he should be taking certainly not Weinstein heat about it. But, you know, but until you step up and say, like, yeah, that was a bad call, you kind of earn the heat until you take it off yourself.
I like the taxonomy of heat. That's terrific. Well, so I want to talk to everybody about this. But, Bill, I'll start over here with you. I mean, one of the other questions that comes up here is, to what degree can somebody outside a culture write about that culture? It's one of the ways in which the need for sensitivity readers. And by the way, I agree with Rich that they should probably call it something else. It just sounds so 2017. Well, I don't know. See, I'm not going to Bono. I will not Bono.
Flamethrower. I can't help myself.
That's right.
But wait, I like that about
Bono's
you.
A verb now?
I'm trying. Yeah. I am trying to make Bono a verb right now.
Verb,
yeah.
And an adjective.
So there's, I mean, and this is an old question, right? And what are the, among the things cited are, you know, I mean, Styron writing Confessions of Nat Turner, or, you know, I mean, take your pick. To me, well, anyway, I'd be interested to hear what, I want to hear what the panel says.
Well, there is no such thing as an unbiased point of view, and mine is certainly biased about this because I wrote a book about Spike Lee's films. Mm-hmm. And I am not a man of color. So if we took this to its logical extension, should I not have been able to write that book? There, I'm sure.
But I did totally assume you were a black man, having not met you, and just read the emails and saw the book.
He's got brother all over him.
Yeah, yeah. let's talk about that offline. offline? Well, in some ways, yeah. So, you know, I stand by what I wrote, but I'm sure there were some blind spots in it. And in some ways, I might have welcomed a sensitivity reader while I was doing that work. I hate the name, by the way. Mm-hmm. I think part of the problem is what this is being called. Mm-hmm. But I would have appreciated that type of feedback from diverse readers to you know, kind of point out to me, like, well, what about this point that you're making? Have you thought about this? I would not have wanted it to function as like a type of censorship, mm-hmm. or to be told that, no, you are not someone who is allowed to write this book. So I think that can go too far as well in terms of, you know, questions of who can speak and cultural appropriation.
I don't know. Tanisha, this, where do you fall? It is a hard
one, right? It's so hard for me because I spend so much time in my work trying to align people to the themes of the work they're doing, because I actually think that it does enrich the work ultimately. I also am a person who believes in intersectionality, so I think that you can write about all different aspects of yourself. You are a man working in media, and so you can come from that perspective and offer that. But it is hard for me because I agree there are some great works written by people who are so outside of an experience, and that is what imagination and art making is at its heart. But I think that there is something to be said if authenticity is where is your aim. That I think it's difficult to achieve that without at least the bumpers of people who come from that life around you.
Yeah, I think it does. I don't know. I mean, Rich, one of the things I pointed out in the emails was a couple of years ago for a show, I was up in Lenox watching Merchant of Venice, which I can guarantee you no sensitivity reader would have allowed William Shakespeare. They would have tried to talk William Shakespeare out of this anyway.
Right. Of course.
And I had these Jewish women sitting behind me who were just not having it. I mean, they were just not having it. And so we did a little forum after that. We did a radio show with Jonathan Epstein, who played Shylock in that production. And I talked about those women. And he goes, well, good. They weren't having it. Why should they have it? But you want to have that play and have that conversation. And, I mean, Shakespeare doesn't probably really know that much other than being fabulously imaginative. Like, whatever his idea of a Jew was at that moment in history was probably somewhat flawed. But like, he wrote it anyway.
Yeah.
And then we have to live with it one way or another.
I see absolutely no value in retroactive social norming. Mm-hmm. What history was is what history was. And Huck Finn can say we could say all kinds of things about Huck Finn and, you know, what was in that book. And we can teach it in classrooms. And when we teach it in classrooms and not bring it into the modern context, you know, of what's fitfully wrong and, you know, an anti-evolution in that book is where we go wrong.
Well, you said a really interesting thing before that, which was that you said it apropos, I think, of Bono. Mm. But you said that there's a difference between putting something out there that causes trouble and then acknowledging that and embracing that or whatever, or as opposed to going, oh, I just had no idea, you know? So to me, like the most objectionable work of popular culture in American history is probably maybe the most popular work of popular culture in American history. It's Gone with the Wind.
Oh,
yeah.
God, yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But,
that's exactly what I was just going to
reference.
Right. But Margaret Mitchell never said she wasn't a racist. She kind of enjoyed being a racist.
But she wasn't asked to either.
Right.
I was going to cite that as an example. Like, imagine if Gone with the Wind had had to go through sensitivity readers or sensitivity viewers come the film.
Well, I would say the world would be a better place without Gone with the Wind in it.
If I may add, I think that Gone with the Wind probably did go through sensitivity readers, and that's exactly where it ended up. Yeah. You know, I think that the stuff that was going on there was a hell of a lot worse than what's in Gone with the Wind right now, frankly.
From book to movie, there was definitely some sensitivity reading, because the studios just wouldn't let some of that stuff stand. But it's still a pretty, you know.
Like, but that's the problem with it, though, right? That it covers up and it whitewashes, and I use that phrase literally. I mean, I think that is the problem with it, that it doesn't reveal the horror.
Right.
That this is all just so wonderful and everyone's just so happy with all of this.
Right, and Greece. That came from probably a sensitivity reader situation.
Yeah, apparently.
I think sometimes you're better off having that flame, like poking that and getting that out there and documenting a perspective so that it's out in the open to talk about more.
Does it matter if that provocation is intentional or not, though?
Well, and I Gone with the Wind's a great example, too, because there are all kinds of, as Donald Trump would say, very nice people. But I really mean
with
very
really
nice people.
Really great clothes. Yeah. I'm sorry.
No, but like very nice people who like Gone with the Wind. I mentioned in my email, I was interviewing Bernie Sanders' wife during the campaign, and it was either her favorite book or her favorite movie. I can't remember. It was movie. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what?
So I turned that movie on. It was probably in the middle or towards the end. And I've actually never seen it through because all I saw was this black woman turning to camera and saying, I don't know nothing about birthing no babies. And I was like, get this away from me.
You know, that's Academy Award winner.
Right. I just can't hang in with
that
kind of
nonsense.
Well, we
could go back to Birth of a Nation, right, as a celebration of the KKK.
But people know what that is. Mm-hmm. Like, everybody knows what that is. I mean, Griffith may be a great filmmaker. Okay. We can all say about that. But everybody knows what that is. I think Gone with the Wind is much more stealth racism and stealth celebration of slavery. It makes slavery look like this rather charming institution.
No, I remember in high school, because I'm that old, like a bunch of, white girls in my classes reading Gone with the Wind and absolutely falling in love with it as a romance novel.
Right, which it works very well as, but it's still... Anyway, we have to... you have the last word.
I was just going to say, they were, in their minds, they're embracing the romance and deleting all of the context that it's set in. And I mean, there's something to... That is a whole other problem.
Framing is important.
That's a question I'm curious if they're actually deleting.
Right. Well, we have to go. We have to move on to the Crown, where we will have, I think, a similarly divided. I tell you, we could have just published the emails that led up to this show and not done the show. The emails were so interesting, but we didn't. We're doing the show, so the Crown is next. All right, we are back with the news here in studio. It's a cast of thousands. Well, it's a cast of four. Anyway, it's Bill Usman. I'm not going to say everybody's titles right now. I'll be here all day. Bill Usman, Tanisha Dugan, Rich Holland, and Carolyn Payne are all with me. We've been watching The Nose. We've been watching The Crown. The Crown and The Nose sounds like kind of a cozy little pub somewhere.
Yes. Yeah, I drink there.
Watching The Nose would be fun.
Right, actually. Watching The Nose would be good, yeah. So Claire Foy is watching The Nose right now. We're watching The Crown, in which Claire Foy plays is Queen Elizabeth II. It's been on for 2 seasons. It is the most expensive TV show ever made. It's a lot of other things as well. And it is sort of a bullet train racing through history across the British landscape and the landscape of the world through the eyes of a very unusual group of people, people who have a very different perspective from the rest of us, the royal family of England. So first of all, let's begin with a clip from the series. I think we are going to hear a clip from one of the episodes of the second season in which a lord, winds up calling out Queen Elizabeth for the fact that she, even by the standards of that time, which was 1957, I can't remember what year it is in the series, she is not at all in the least bit woke.
Is my voice all right? You can't understand me.
Yes.
Not too strangled. Not too much a pain in the neck.
No.
Good. So, what is it that you'd have me change?
It's not so much what I'd have you change, just an acknowledgement that it has changed.
What?
Everything. And to prepare yourself for the fact we now live in a time where people like me
can say exactly what they think.
Yes.
In any way they want.
Yes.
And remind me, why is that exactly?
Because the age of deference is over.
And what is left without deference? Anarchy.
Equality.
How can it be equality when I cannot return the fire?
You can. But I struggle to think of a moment in history where it has worked to a monarch's advantage to return fire on their own people.
But you have managed to think of how this monarch might use something to her advantage.
I have.
And that same monarch is sitting before, forgive me, a failed politician and an unrecognized journalist, and taking his advice on how to do her job.
The situation is as baffling to me as it is to you, Your Majesty.
All right, that is from the second season of The Crown. So, Rich, I know you have some problems with this series. You've got a lot of problems with this series. But some of those problems, I think, are almost summed up in that clip a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that.
Aye, aye. So
we may have to request extra time from here and now.
All right. So to me the biggest problem that I have with this series is personal. It's about a matter of perspective. I can't look at these people see them through any sort of Gaussian screen. I can't see them through beautiful. I can't see what the beautiful light masks. You know, I see people who are brutal killers in an intense chess game of managing power. I was born to refute that, and so I can't be conned into finding any sort of glamorization, into seeing that as anything that's glamorous or desirable, and frankly, I delight at its growing irrelevance. So when I take a look at a series like this, that to your point, Colin, is like a bullet train or an express train that picks intentionally the stops that it's going to stop at, and the neighborhoods that it's going to skip. I take a look at, you know, this masterpiece of power manipulation. I see filmmakers who strike me as wanting to adore a thing that creates a tremendous amount of injury. And so I can't get behind it.
I don't know, Tanisha, do you not buy the argument that this is a lens of adoration all the way through? It seems to me that one of the or even a lens of the exaltation of power. It seems that our general relationship with the royal family for decades now has been this is a bunch of chronically unhappy people who routinely do not get what they want. And the fact that they, you know, are incredibly rich and live among all these trappings has not necessarily entitled them to the lives that they wanted.
Yeah, I think I buck against the idea that this series looks at them through a gauze filtered lens. The trappings of their life is that of privilege. That is what it is. And we all are attracted to glitter. But I think what I like about the show is that, as I said in the emails, criminality exists across all castes. And I don't think that I am, that my appreciation for the work or the show negates that fact, which is that I can see that they are bad people, but I also can see the humanness about that. And that's the thing that I'm interested in investigating, and that's the thing that I appreciate about what the show investigates, that Hitler had family and a mother and danced and sang and also did horrible things. I don't think demonizing and avoiding that humanness actually gets us closer to, I don't want to say erasing because that seems so naive and silly, but moving towards a greater understanding by putting them in this box of only the bad parts of human nature can they encompass and not seeing their full humanity, which is the thing that I mean
it's interesting
appreciate about it.
Because you don't choose what you're born into and what your circumstances are, and this show does do an amazing job. I mean, I can't really 100% say that I enjoyed the show. I didn't, like, hate it, like most things that I have to watch for this show. But I'm not going to tell you to, like, rush and watch it. And this is coming from somebody who has to spend the next 4 weeks on a couch. I will not be, like, watching The Crown. Sorry. But I thought that this show was at its best when you saw these characters in these very, There are moments that are relatable as a human, just on that raw human level. And that is thanks, I think, to the amazing acting. I do think that the actors are spectacular in it. I think that that's where the show is at its mm-hmm. best, is these actors bringing out the struggle, like where you see a woman who this is her reality, that and there's this underlying. She probably would give anything to not have to be in that reality.
She says that frequently. She'd rather not have any of this stuff. So, by the way, don't get too attached to these actors because there's going to be a season 3 and none of them are in it. They're all being sacked. Genially sacked. So Bill, you had a lot of ambivalence. Not even ambivalence. You had a lot of resistance to the idea of watching the series.
Yes, I did.
Kicking and screaming, I think, was the term that you used. And then you kind of got locked in.
Yeah. True confession, I did not want to watch this show. When it first appeared, I refused to watch it. I did not want to like this show to the extent that when I told my wife that I was being called to duty by Colin to watch this show, she literally started laughing at me. I despise the monarchy. Just like Rich said, I despise everything that they've done. I despise everything that they stand for. And yet this particular piece of media completely and totally seduced me. I admit it. I was seduced by this. I was seduced by the acting, the writing, the look of it, the feel of it, the music, the amazing faces of some of the people who were cast. Mm-hmm. All of it just sucked me in. And I think that's actually the danger of it. Mm-hmm. And there is a connection here to
Gone with the Crown. Yeah, I know.
Yeah. Right? Gone with the Crown.
Absolutely. I think this is how propaganda works.
Yep.
That it made me forget momentarily about my resistance. I had to keep saying to myself, okay, this is not really Queen Elizabeth. This is Claire Foy, who is amazing and seductive and beautiful, but this is not Queen Elizabeth II. These are not the people who did these horrible things. You know, I wonder what a sensitivity reader from Egypt would have said about the depiction of what happened in the Suez Canal. You know, so to me, it's It's simultaneously an amazing piece of media that is incredibly seductive, but also dangerous because of that.
Can I just say, as an Irish American and the spawn of a large Irish Catholic,
and that's coming.
Yeah, that's coming. I mean, season three, will be, I think, a lot about that. It will be about Princess Margaret calling the Irish pigs, and it'll be about the killing of probably the most sympathetic character in the series, Dickie Mountbatten, the blowing up of Dickie Mountbatten by the IRA, and I don't know. Like, first of all, one thing that I would say is that the crown is powerless and has been powerless for a really long time. I don't think that Queen Elizabeth really had the ability to direct British policy at the time, even of the Suez Crisis. So it's kind of hard for me to – as I watch this series, I feel like it's pretty easy to get, you know, which parts of these of this series is are about objectionable people associated with an objectionable institution, and which part, as Carolyn is saying, are human about human beings who never particularly chose their fate. They're just sort of there trying to figure out what to do with all that and having complex ideas of duty. We often see that they are, as I said at the beginning, miserable. I mean, I hadn't quite understood how completely miserable and horrible Prince Philip's childhood was and how determined he was to foist that exact paradigm onto poor Prince Charles. I don't know. I feel like it's a mixed enough thing. So
maybe it's a lot like The Great Gatsby in that way.
I don't feel like I'm being invited to love and worship and exalt these people.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So I just want to key on to what you were saying, Bill, about this idea of it being of the propaganda tools that are still alive in our media. Around manifesting these ideas of, you know, of glorious white privilege. There's in this movie there were these two photographers that were being drawn, and those were, to me, I mean, you know, might be trade issues based on, you know, what I do professionally, but they were the interesting part. You know, to watch that subtext of media propaganda run through and media manipulation run through this series. On one hand, we had Cecil Beaton, who even as he was taking the photographs of these folks, you could hear the language that he's speaking to them to try and get them in character. He's selling them the myth of who they are so that they could present that back to him. So that's what could get shared out in all of its lovely pink light. And frankly, the exact lighting that was replicated over and over in every scene of this movie. And then you had Tony Armstrong Jones, on the other hand, who seemed determined to get under this thing and get to the true essence of who at least Princess Margaret was, but interestingly enough, she's probably the one who is most unmonarchy of all of these folks. You know, the one who had abdicated the opportunity to actually even follow through with any kind of real leadership in this family. But taking a look at this tension between what's propaganda and what's authentic set up a dynamic with which I was watching this entire series, you know, so I was asking that question every step of the way.
But
what's real and what's baloney?
Because I feel like if we're going to be, look at your own Instagram, right? Your Instagram to me, and I'm not saying yours personally, I'm saying one's, the royal you.
That would be a very personal attack.
I don't have an Instagram, so there.
And it does exactly that. It shows the version of you that you want to present. And it has nothing to do with the pieces that are underneath. Those are not the things that we show in a public form. And you can, and I think we can pretend to have whatever conversation we want to have about it, about how authentic that actually is or how authentic your personal version of that is. But truthfully, it is a show. And we all participate in the show, regardless of whether or not we are born into privilege, we are an oligarch, we are Trump, or we are the queen, or you're Tanisha Dugan. You know, we participate in the show of life because that is the way in which the life is built.
And in season one, this is what Churchill hates so much about that portrait that was painted of him, right? That it shows him as he actually is, mm-hmm. an aging, weak, frail man, which was, I think, a great metaphor for the fears of the British Empire mm-hmm. themselves, seeing themselves as weak and aging and past their prime.
And I we're going to have to wrap this up, and it's too bad. I could talk about this for an hour. Mm-hmm. I do want to say, I think one of the reasons I wanted to talk about this series is that even in England right now, this series is seen as poking a stick in exactly the way that people are talking about right now. It's some of the most cherished myths. So Philip is portrayed as much more of an adulterer, and at times, you know, maybe even in the case of the Profumo scandal, a real bounder and toxic kind of person.
He's my favorite, actually, in the show. He is just so awful that I really enjoyed, like, he captivated me the most.
And even though the fascist leanings of Edward VIII are just a matter of historical record, this series goes further and in a way that has been very discomforting to the British public. Mm-hmm. And then at a certain point, even though I think they get everything wrong about it, I think the filmmakers say, and you know, don't you Americans sit there and look at all this and happily watch our myths explode, because we're going to show you the Kennedys, and we're going to, in a very awkward way, strip off some of that myth too, because you guys are every bit as bad as we are about believing your own propaganda. Anyway, we have to stop. So I'm sorry for having the last word, but I was feeling passionate. All right, we're going to come back and we're going to do some recommendations.
Today's show is produced by Queen Betsy I, the Duke of Pants, Lady Amanda Fish, and me, Kyone Wolf. The part of Bill Curry was played by Helen Mirren. On Monday, revisit our show about time. And now, back to Colin.
All right. We've had a lively nose panel here, and now it's time. We'll have Carolyn go last, because I think people should recommend things that Carolyn, who has a broken ankle, just to repeat, and is going to be housebound and couchbound for quite a while.
Yes, hopefully, large gifts and alcohol are greatly appreciated during that time.
But also things to watch and read and listen to and think about and stuff like that. So, Bill, you go first.
Okay. So I had a lot, actually. This past year, I had to find some culture to help me deal with the reality that we're living in, and it takes a while to create books and movies and television shows, so we haven't, I think, yet fully gotten to that moment where artists are going to respond to the political situation that we find ourselves in. But I did, but there was a lot that still spoke to me in relationship to that. So the first thing I want to endorse is a double feature of two documentaries. I Am Not Your Negro, which was built from the words of James Baldwin, but I think very much speaks to the moment that we're living in. And I think that can be very fruitfully paired with Get Out by Jordan Peele.
Yo, homie, you took one of my recommendations.
You can still,
I'm playing.
And Jonathan McNichol mentioned it also when we first started talking about this. It's worth it. And if you're not sure why I referred to it as a documentary, just Google was Get Out a documentary, and you'll find some interesting commentary about that from Jordan Peele. And then I also want to endorse two nonfiction books by poets. The first is by Matthew Zapruder, and it's a book called Why Poetry, where I think he makes a really persuasive and well-constructed and elegant argument for why poetry should not be overlooked, why we need poetry, why the way we teach poetry actually turns people off to it and makes us think that it's this language that we can't understand when really we can, and that it's an essential part of our existence. And then the other one is by Kevin Young, who is an award-winning poet and the new poetry editor of The New Yorker. And this is his second nonfiction book, and this one is called Bunk, the rise of hoaxes, humbug, plagiarists, phonies, post-facts, and fake news. And he makes a really provocative argument in this book. He goes through the history of these sorts of hoaxes and phonies and fakes, but he connects them all to the history of race in the United States.
I'm going to stop you just there so we don't run out of time. Tanisha, what have you got?
Well, I'll go with Get Out to start. And I actually I'll speak on the documentary piece because those of us who are in the craft know for a fact that it's actually not a documentary. But the reason Jordan goes towards so hard at it as a documentary is that he doesn't want the majority to negate the truths in which this work of fiction offers. And every time I see it, I see something else, and it's all good. He's got a New York Times article that I would check out too, which is a great supplementary about his background, which sort of illuminates the whys and the wherefores this particular artist took on this kind of work. The second is I'm recommending the artist Solange, because the work, although it came out at the fall of 2016, actually toured most of 2017, and she gave us a whiff of a singer, performance artist who was giving us sort of these full stage visual phantasmas that I loved, and also put Black Girl Magic front and center, and gave us some things like Cranes in the Sky, which I love. And then finally, I'm going to endorse this little city that we're all in by way of the Greater Hartford Academy of the Arts. And I say that because as I work and play in this space, I learn and realize more and more that the architects of culture come from this place, this high school that when I went was on Wethersfield Avenue. And it's changed and it has become something else.
Truly amazing place. We just, because we're going to run out of time, I'm going to have to pass the ball down the line.
Dang.
Cool. So for Caroline, I have three recommendations for you. The first one should be ready about the time that you're off your cast. I want to recommend everybody jump on social media and connect with No Good Market. That's no as in yes, I know that. Good Market. You get the opportunity to go to food trucks and to a happening once a month in nice weather where people are actually being real and being in community and you know, and showing care and love for each other.
And it's over in Parkville on Bartholomew Street.
Exactly. Next, I want to recommend a book that at one point feels like a picture book, but it's so much more than that. It's from a fashion designer's book called China Chic. It's Vivian Tam's book, and I've admired her forever. And she takes on the challenges of a culture that could that has so much been sort of eroticized and fetishized, and combats that by doing deep research into from where she came, and so every little bit of the culture that she puts into her work has been explored over centuries and centuries of history.
Do the last one really quick. Last one 2 minutes left in the whole show.
Okay, cool. Last one really quick will be go get this children's book, and I read it every time I get muddled. It's Bob Dylan's Forever Young. It's illustrated by Paul Younger. It's Dylan lyrics set to beautiful illustrations. It slows down the song, and boy, it wakes up your activism and your optimism.
That's great. Carolyn, do you have any recommendations?
Yes, I do. Okay. There's a show called Hot Date. It's on Pop Network. It is a sketch comedy show. Emily Axford, she's a Chicago-based comedian. She and her husband co-wrote it, co-star in it. It is brilliant. They play this cast of characters. It is really well done, comedy that is great for the dark days of winter. And my other recommendation is a rare moment of non-snarky philosophy from me, as somebody who is used to moving and being constantly on the go. And this year has been a rough year for a lot of people. And this reminded me, this injury and everything this year has just been like one of those things to just keep swimming. I love sharks. And, you know, sharks, if they don't swim, most breeds of sharks, if they don't move, they die. And like when this first happened to me, that's how I was feeling. I just felt so stifled. But I realized that this whole year has been a rough year for a lot of people. We're about to enter 2018. We've all just kept moving. And that's what I think is my endorsement for 2018. Keep moving, keep doing things, and we'll all get through this.
All right. I think I'm going to – well, you can start playing the music if you want, Wolvie. I will quickly endorse – there's a moment in The Queen where Harold Macmillan finds himself being insulted by a comedy group. It's Beyond the Fringe, which was Monty Python before there was Monty Python. You might want to discover Beyond the Fringe. You can find some of their stuff on YouTube. Also, Lois Smith, what a great actress. She's the nun in Lady Bird, but she's in a film called Marjorie Prime, which I don't have time to describe here, but it's on Amazon. You can watch it, and we might talk about it at a future show.